Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
My guest on today's show has been screaming obscenities at Larry David for more than two decades.
You sick fuck, Larry David. What the fuck do you think you're doing getting my kid drunk?
Drunk? What are you talking about?
She's slurring her words. She's bumping into things. She stinks like a fucking wino.
Oh, I poured some of your... I had poured some wine.
Oh, she must have accidentally, a seven-year-old kid, drank some wine.
It was the glasses got...
Do I look like a fucking idiot that I'm gonna believe you? You got her drunk and you stole the fucking dog, all right?
No, she told me I could have the dog.
She told you you could take the dog after you got her all fucked up on alcohol, all liquored up.
I thought she had a speech impediment.
You've known the kid since she was born, and she suddenly develops a speech impediment?
That's what was so puzzling
to
me. Oh,
listen, you four-eyed fuck. You stole the dog. She's at home hysterical that her dog is gone. I don't know what you did to him. Maybe you brought him for some, like, animal testing or something. You sicko fucko asshole. Get me the fucking dog!
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and that was the great Susie Essman dressing down Larry David all the way back in season 3 of Curb Your Enthusiasm. 20 years later, the show is in its 11th season on HBO, and she hasn't let up yet. Before she became Susie Green on Curb, Susie Essman was a formidable stand-up comedian in her own right. That's how she met Larry David way back before the Seinfeld days, in New York's Catch a Rising Star Comedy Club. On this week's show, we get into all of it, from her first impressions of Larry to what it's been like to play this heightened version of herself on screen for a full third of her life. And just for fun, we also talk about roasting the hell out of Donald Trump in 2004 and my other favorite performance of hers as Alana's mom on Broad City. All right, brace yourselves. Here's me with Susie Essman. All right. Well, it's so great to meet you and to be doing this. I've just been such a big fan of yours for so long now. And it's
Thank
so
you,
great
Matt.
To have it's so great to have Curb Your Enthusiasm back in our lives as well.
Always
welcome. I've really been enjoying every week. And we're talking the morning after the episode aired where Susie embroiders the KKK robe. So that was a particularly fun one.
That was a great episode. That to me was a classic Curb.
It really was. It was a great, like, everything comes together at the end episode.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're waiting to see how the watermelon's going to play in and the robe's going to play in. And
well, that's the genius of Larry and Jeff Schaefer. I mean, the way these two figure out the plot outlines and weave everything. And they've done it with the whole season. I mean, you'll see in episode 10 how every storyline comes together in episode 10.
Amazing.
So they do it within an episode and then within the arc of a season. It's incredible how they do it. I don't even know how they get there. It's transcendent to me.
Yeah. the season premiere was particularly great, I think. And it was really fun to see Albert Brooks in the show, to get him in, especially because it felt like kind of a, even though it wasn't mentioned, it felt like a kind of tribute to his brother, Bob Einstein, right?
Yes, except that he played Albert Brooks. He didn't play Albert Funkhauser.
Right. But just to have him there and sort of to have him, it was helped us remember Bob as well.
We all miss Bob every day.
Yeah, he was just so funny on the show and just such a legend.
So funny and so singular. And, you know, you can't replace that kind of comedic voice. It's completely original. And I mean, you could get other people in there. And Vince Vaughn, I think, has been terrific as Freddie Funkhauser, replacing some storyline things. But there's only one Bobby.
Yes, yes. What was it like working with Albert Brooks? Did you know him before this or?
I didn't. I had met him a few times. I think the first time I met him was at Shiva for Bob, I think, actually. It was fun. It was a lot of fun. You know, I get to work with people that I've spent my entire lifetime admiring. So it's kind of a treat.
Yeah. I thought maybe Albert was going to be kind of like become a regular on the show the way he was introduced. Does he come back at all? Or was that a one-time?
No, it was a one-time.
That was a one-time thing.
One-time
yeah.
guest star.
What did you do?
What did I do? You plopped down on the couch.
I didn't plop.
You plopped.
You are so fucking skinny. Your arms can't even hold a fucking
glass.
Oh,
get out of here, skinny.
Puny,
you,
puny,
you plopped
puny.
Down. You don't even know how to sit on a couch.
I didn't plop.
Did she plop?
Oh, like I'm gonna say.
Did she plop?
I'm not taking sides on this.
Oh my God, what happened?
The couch is ruined.
What in the world?
He was unsteady in his
she
hand.
She plopped
and it
down on the couch and it spilled.
It's gonna stain.
You know what? We'll pay for it.
Well, excuse me. No, we. You'll pay for
no,
it.
No, no.
I didn't do a fucking thing.
You're completely responsible for that stain.
Hey, I got a great idea. Why don't you two start a GoFundMe page?
Oh, fuck you, Albert.
Fuck me?
Yeah.
All right, I'm going with plopped.
Yeah, he's pretty elusive, so it was pretty impressive that you guys got him for one episode. You're now 20 plus years into doing this show, I mean, which is kind of insane.
Crazy.
Did you ever imagine when it started that you would still be doing this, you know, 22 years later?
I didn't even know we were going to do season two. I mean, I didn't have a contract. I was a day player for several seasons. I was a day player. I never, every season, Larry would say, that's it. I'm done. I'm not coming back.
Yeah.
And clearly that wasn't the case. He did stop for 6 years after episode season eight. Never in my wildest imagination would I have thought then that 21 years later, we'd be still working and doing this. I'm thrilled with it. I'm happy about that. But I never thought this was going to last, or I never knew. Not only did I not know if we were going to come back, I didn't know if I was even going to be in it. You know, season two, I was only in two episodes.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, they were great ones. It was The Doll and Thor. I never knew if I was coming back. It was just very hit or miss, touch and go.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty unique experience to play a character over this many years. You know, not that many people can say that they've done it. What is that like for you to kind of, you know, live with this person who's maybe has some similarities to you, but is not you over so much time?
We all started out old, so it's not like we've aged out of our characters. You know, I mean, there's no age issue with any of our characters. I don't think so. So we weren't like beautiful people, ingenues, that were like running around in bikinis. So it's not like we can't do that anymore. You know, I remember after season eight, when Larry called me and he said, that's it, we're done. And he was very definitive about it. And he meant it at the time. And we were done for 6 years. And I remember going into a depression about not being this character anymore, not putting on those crazy outfits anymore.
Yeah.
And I really missed her. I really missed playing her and being her, because I have so much fun being her, because I get to channel all that anger and all that Susie Greenness that's not me. That is so much fun to play. So I'm not tired of playing her. They keep on giving me new things. Jeff and Larry keep on coming up with new fun things for me to do. If he wants to do season 12, 13, 14, I'm on board.
Yeah, yeah. I read somewhere that you actually, in the audition or in the process at the very beginning, you actually called Jeff Garland a fat fuck in the very first time you acted with him. Is that true?
No, that's not true. First of all, I didn't audition. Larry just called me and gave me the part. We knew each other from way back in our stand-up years. And I met him at Catch a Rising Star in, I don't know, 1985, 1986, something like that. And he was a comic and I was a comic. And, you know, Jeff was a comic. I think Jeff came to New York later in the late 80s. And I met him then. So we all knew each other. He gave me the part after seeing me on a roast of Jerry Stiller. That was on Comedy Central, where, you know, on roasts, you got to be really blue. It's required. And I was, and my act was always blue anyway. And I think that I hadn't seen him for 10 years because he had moved to LA to do Seinfeld. And it was like, you know, a light bulb moment. He was like, oh, Susie, she's the perfect one to play Jeff's wife. And he just called me and gave me the job. But it was, you know, it was no budget, no money, I mean, it was so low budget in the beginning. We didn't even have trailers. We didn't even have a makeup trailer. Everything was just like on location. And, you know, we didn't even have porta potties for the crew. It was all just kind of like, I got a barn, let's put on a show kind of a feeling. In the first season, there was an episode called The Wire, where Jeff brings a Fresh Air Fund kid into our house and the kid robs us blind. And it was that episode why Larry wanted to hire me particularly for the part. And in the show, the only direction that Larry gave me for that scene was, I want you to rip Jeff a new asshole, which, you know, I could do that. Yeah. I knew that that would be fun. And I'm screaming at Jeff and yelling and cursing. It was like, I want you to like really go with the language. And so I did. And, you know, every fuck this, that, and the other thing. And then he keeps on pulling me aside. Larry keeps pulling me aside and says, go further, go further. And I thought I was going pretty far. And finally, he pulls me aside and he says, make fun of Jeff's fat. And I said, I don't want to do that, Larry, because I that's not my comedy. I don't make fun of the way people look and things they can't change about themselves. And it's just not, I feel like that's kind of low and it's not a place that I like to go. And he's like, just do it, just do it. It's going to be funny. He knows you're only acting, just do it. And that was the first time I called him a fat fuck. And that was like, then the genie was out of the bottle,
yeah,
you know?
Then it stuck. Yeah, I mean, I think most people know by now that Curb is not scripted, that it's you are given these scenarios and then you kind of have to just, you know, improvise. Did that take a while for you to get used to, or was it pretty easy right off the bat to do that style?
Like a fish to water, Matt. I just took to it. I'm a comic. And so, and I am the kind of comic that improvises a lot on stage. Not all comics do. Some comics have their, you know,
yeah, very tightly, yeah.
I always know what the first line I'm going to say. And beyond that, it was a free for all. Not that I don't do material, I do, but I never do it in the same order. And I'm always playing with the audience. So for me, it was really easy. Once I figured out who the character was and what our relationships were, which was right away, that was set up in that same episode, The Wire, the antagonism, you know, me dealing with these two buffoons. it's always been really easy and a joy for me. I mean, I love it. I just love working that way because for two reasons. One, I don't have to memorize lines, which I hate to do.
Yeah, that sounds
and two,
great.
I'm writing, I'm a part of the creative process. I'm not just given something to say and have to figure out some acting thing of my motivation and interpretation and all that acting, you know, lingo. I'm actually writing it in the moment. And you have to really, when you're improvising, improvising is all about, well, you're an interviewer, so you know about this. It's all about talking and listening is the most important thing. You know, you have to listen.
Is there a time that you could remember where you, you know, where something came out of listening in a way that you, that surprised you or sort of a choice that you made that was based on something that the other actor was doing that really like sort of exemplifies this?
All the time. I mean, every scene. I mean, every scene. I'm trying to think of something from last night's episode. I never know what I'm going to say ahead of time, ever. So in every scene, something Larry will say will trigger something that I'll say.
Mm-hmm. I could imagine that not, you know, that the guest stars that come on, not everyone is used to working in this way. And are there people that you've worked with who either were particularly good at it in a surprising way or struggled with it in a surprising way?
Larry hires a lot of stand-ups who are generally good at improvising and improv actors too. I mean, Cheryl is from the Groundlings. Cheryl's not a stand-up. She's from the Groundlings.
Great, yeah. We've had so many people on this podcast who are, you know, either come up from the sketch and improv world who have populated the show over the years.
So those people, they know what they're doing and they know how to improvise. But then there are actors, you know, real actors who come on and some are fantastic and some have trouble with it. John Hamm, perfect example, because he was so funny in episode one. Great improviser, you know, really, but he's a real actor, John Hamm, you know.
But I mean, also a big comedy fan, so maybe he's picked
correct,
up some things
correct.
From...
but he, I mean, he was just a natural improviser, just a terrific natural improviser. You know, I remember when Bancroft, that was way back in the producer's season, she did not want to improvise. She asked Larry to please tell her what to say.
Yeah, well, she's Anne Bancroft. She could get away with that.
But what's ironic is she's married to one of the great improvisers of all time,
yeah,
you know,
Mel
in
Brooks.
Mel. It didn't come naturally to her as an actress. There were other people, but I don't want to mention their names, but she's dead, so I can mention her. Larry says that the majority of times, you know, I don't know the percentage, what he said, maybe 97, 98% of the time, the actors, us guys who he hires, come up with something better than he ever could have written. 2-3% of the time, he wishes he could have written it.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite Susie storyline over the many years that you think about as sort of like the quintessential Susie moment?
Well, there's so many. I mean, my favorite episode has always been the doll from season 2 for a few reasons. One, I just think it's one of the most perfectly crafted half hours of comedy ever written. And that's really when the Susie Green persona really got established in season 2. You know, you really see that these two are living in fear of her. And that's the first time the spaghetti Western music came up as my kind of theme song. And so that's always, you know, been near and dear to my heart, the doll.
Where's the head? I know you took the doll's head. Where is it? Where's the fucking head?
I don't know.
The kid is home, hysterical, because her doll, Judy, has been decapitated. Because you two sickos took the head for God knows what reason. Some voodoo shit you're doing. Where is it? Stop scratching your balls and tell me where it is. All right, just get me the fucking head, all right? Get me the fucking head, all right? Both of you, because I've had it, you four-eyed fuck and you fat piece of shit. Get me the head!
Has there ever been anything that you've had to do on the show or that's been on the show that actually made you uncomfortable? Because it does push the envelope in so many different ways. And, you know, even including the episode we were talking about from last night with the you know, KKK robe and the hate group and all that. Is there anything that you've been asked to do where you said, I don't know about this. This might be too much.
You know, I really trust Larry and I really trust his sensibility. So no, sometimes I'll read an outline and not stuff with me, but I'll think, oh God, is this going too far? If it's funny, you forgive a lot of things. So no, I completely trust Larry and Jeff Schaefer and their sensibility. And we're so on the same wavelength with so many things that I have no problem with whatever they ask me to do. I'm surprised sometimes, like I'll read an outline and be like, oh, I guess now I have to, you know, learn sign language.
Yeah.
Or I have to, you know, like whatever. There's always things, oh, I guess this year I have to, you know, learn how to sew or, you know, whatever it is. I didn't have to learn how to sew.
Yeah. yeah. I mean, I always feel like Curb is one of those shows that's kind of grandfathered in terms of what it
yes.
can get away with. You know, especially these shows that have been on for so long, you know, people talk about that with South Park or, you know, some of these shows that if it came out today.
The political correctness you're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder about that. I mean, I think that, and I've said this before, I think that Larry is so politically incorrect that he's correct, you know, and he's got the last laugh. I mean, the laugh is always on him in that sense. And he's an equal opportunity offender. He offends everybody, every ethnicity, every gender, every yeah. whatever.
And mostly himself, probably.
Yeah, exactly. But I do wonder, and I don't know, we have no way of knowing, if it aired for the first time today, how it would be received. I don't know.
Yeah, I think people forgive things that have been on for so long and sort of say, well, that's just that, you know, we've accepted it and it's been, you know, to turn on it now would seem kind of ridiculous to say all of a sudden.
You know,
it's offensive.
So much of that stuff is intent also, you know, and I know Larry's intent and I know how pure his intent is. You know, and what an old lefty he is also.
Yeah, that was I thought it was the question of intent was really funny around the episode with the where he's wearing the MAGA hat, you know, around town. And then,
yes.
of course, Trump himself decided to take it totally out of context and tweet a clip of it, you know, sort of implying
that it was
supporting him.
Not realizing that it was being used as a repellent.
Yeah. Yeah, he really didn't understand the intent of that one.
But, you know. Well, he understands nothing about anything.
Yeah, right.
When you think about that episode, what's so interesting what Larry does in that episode is clearly he's using the MAGA hat as a repellent, but he's at the same time showing the the small-mindedness of the left at the same time. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's so complicated how he does it, because it's not just the anti-MAGA. It's also showing the knee-jerk reaction that people have to it and why we're in this polarized place we are from both ends right now.
Exactly. Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, that you met Larry way back, you know, sort of in the mid 80s at Catch a Rising Star. You have this very interesting relationship with him on the show where you are able to sort of scream at each other and, you know, and be furious with each other. But then moments later, you're sort of back on friendly terms.
Right.
And I know you've kind of described it as like a sibling type relationship.
Yeah.
How do you think about that in terms of being the relationship that Susie and Larry have on screen? And is there any part of it that mirrors your real life relationship with him?
No, our real life relationship is, I don't think we've ever had a fight. Ever. We get along. We have a really close relationship and we are very close friends and get along really well and understand each other really well. And have, you know, I mean, the key to getting along well with Larry is to have really good boundaries. I understand Larry and Larry understands me. And so, no, but one of the reasons we can speak to each other in that despicable way is because we know we're just playing. You know, we're just playing. We're not, there's nothing real about it at all.
Yeah. But I love that there's also this sort of like real close, loving relationship between Susie and Larry on screen too, where they have a lot in common in a lot of ways. And they do sometimes, you know, sort of see eye to eye on things in surprising ways, especially like in these later seasons, there's been so much time together.
Yeah. And their family. I mean, you know, I think in that episode last night, he says, you know, I'm sorry to drop in. I'm like, you always drop in.
Exactly.
He's the Harry Von Zell, who you probably don't even know what that is. That was from the Burns and Allen show, the neighbor who always just dropped in. He's like, you know, he's a part. That was one of the things, you know, just to go back about Bob, losing Bob. It's this little family that we have. You know, and we just accept one another on screen. We just all, it's family. And when you lose a member of your family like that, it was hard.
Going back to those early days when you met Larry, what were your first impressions of him as a comedian, in those early days?
Oh, well, he was brilliant as a comedian. I mean, his material was like nobody else's material. You know, I mean, he would come up with about, oh God, you know, about being the next door neighbor of Jonas Salk's mother. Like he's crazy. Or one of my favorites of his was, you know, when you're in the Old West and they come asking you to join the posse. You know, I mean, he would come up with these scenarios that were these short stories, really. You know, they were just these short, they were so well fleshed out. You know, Larry, we would all watch him because he was just so brilliantly funny. All the comedians would go in the room. And we would also go in the room to watch him because you just never knew what he was going to do. I mean, he would just look at annoyed. If one person was looking at their watch and everybody else was laughing, he would get annoyed and storm off the stage. You know, he was just volatile and fun to watch.
Kind of legendary for those moments.
Yeah, exactly.
Where he would get frustrated.
So he was always, but you know, you always want, I remember once in the very beginning, somebody said that Larry had been watching me do a set and there was one of my bits that he thought was really great. And that was like meant a lot to me that Larry thought I wrote a really great bit, you know, that way back in the early years, like you wanted his approval, you know, because he didn't give it, you know, he was very judicious in how he gave his approval.
So you weren't surprised by the success of Seinfeld because you knew how brilliant he was, or was that, that come as
that
a surprise that it sort of took off the way it did?
You know, I think the success of Seinfeld was surprising in a sense, you know, that it was this very New York, very Jewish show. That it was so successful.
Yeah.
You know, it was
the most
successful show in the history of television or something like that. So I think that was a little surprising, but not really when you really take it up. It was funny.
Yeah. I mean, it's undeniable,
time.
Right?
But
it is, I've always thought about that too, how it's so specific New York Jewish humor that somehow it just appealed to everybody.
But then then again, you know, the history of humor in this country is so specific, New York Jewish humor.
Right.
So maybe that's just the rhythms people were used to.
I was curious if there was ever sort of an alternate universe where you could have played Elaine on the show. Was that ever,
auditioned for Elaine. I did audition for Elaine.
Yes.
I did audition for Elaine. I remember Larry wasn't there, but Jerry was. But, you know, I really think that Julia was the right person for that part.
Yeah, she's pretty good.
Julia was so brilliant in that part. And the chemistry of everybody. After I saw Julia, I never once had any regret for not getting that part.
Did you audition for a lot of sitcoms during those years?
Yeah.
Is that a strange world to be in, those sort of like competing for those roles on sitcoms
as in the comedy world?
Yeah,
it's horrible.
You didn't
auditioning
like it.
And it's horrible. Listen, this job, I was, first of all, not only has it lasted for 21 years, I was given the part.
You didn't even have to audition.
And there's such a, what's the word I'm looking for? I feel so incredibly grateful that I'm on a show that I would watch, because I could have gotten a part on some crappy, you know, ABC sitcom or whatever. And a lot of those shows just limp along for seven, and you got to sign a 6-7 year contract.
Yeah. And then you're stuck.
And yeah, I would have made a lot of money and that would have been nice, but I wouldn't have been doing anything that I was proud of or that I, you know, could tout in this way. And to be on a show that I personally think might be just way up there in the funniest show in the history of television, there's a few others, but I think it's up there in the running. That's like, oh God, I couldn't ask for anything better.
Coming up, Susie reveals the real life inspiration for her character on Curb and tells us what it really felt like to mock Donald Trump to his face at the Friars Club roast in 2004.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. Check out our conversations with Susie's Curb Your Enthusiasm co-stars like Jeff Garlin, JB Smoove, and more. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to those episodes and everything else from our free archive, and you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Susie Essman. I was watching some clips of your stand-up from back in the day, which I was really, really enjoying. And it struck me that you imitate your mother on stage a lot in those years. And there was I noticed some similarities between Susie Green and the imitation of your mother. Did you think about that at all? How Susie
that is very,
kind of a
very, very perceptive.
So Susie is
nobody
comes from
has ever come up with that before.
Yeah.
Yes, there's definitely parts of my mother and Susie Green. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
How did that kind of manifest? Did you originally think of it that way, or did that evolve over time?
It was unconscious. But after a while, when I looked at it, I did notice that was there. But yes, it was unconscious. definitely unconscious. My mother, you know, she used to, actually today is the 4-year anniversary of her death. She died 4 years ago today on November 15th. But she used to watch my act, and she used to say, that's not me that you're doing. I know that's not me. She thought I was making up this character. It was totally her.
Yeah.
It was completely
her.
She
couldn't see it.
No, she couldn't see it. I changed the voice a little bit. You know, you always want to protect the guilty, but, it was totally her.
My mother, you know, my mother lives for coincidence. It's her whole reason for being in this world, to find small world stories wherever she is, you know? Like, she was very happy I was coming down here because my grandmother used to live here. So You're going to Miami Beach, and Grandma used to live in Miami Beach. Oh, my God. Oh, is that a small world? Oh, is that something?
It's funny. I was looking at you. I know you sort of came up and were good friends with Joy Behar.
Yeah, still. She's my bestie.
Yeah. And I was it's interesting just thinking about how she's been doing The View about as long as you've been doing Curb, right? You both kind of got these jobs that have lasted.
Well, she started 25 years. So she started, we started in 2000. I think she started 1997 or 1998. She started The View. Yeah.
But she kind of, you kind of both have landed these jobs that have become pretty powerful positions in media.
Yes, it's true. It's great. You know, it's great because we both started, well, Larry too. I mean, we all started out so poor. You know, so, you know, struggling. I mean, when I first met Joy, she was a single mother. She lived in a one bedroom apartment where she slept on the couch and her daughter had, you know, like, and she drove this old beat up Monte Carlo. And Larry lived in a studio apartment in Manhattan Plaza on 43rd Street and 10th Avenue. And, you know, we were all struggling. We used to make $7 a night cab fare, they used to call it.
Yeah.
At these clubs that we used to run around working. And we were all struggling. Larry tells stories about how he used to walk around the city looking for spots in case he ever became homeless. That would be a good place to live. Like, this place has a grate with some heat coming up. You know, that would be a good place to live. We were all really struggling. So it's kind of nice that we're all doing quite well.
Do you follow all of the drama at The View, or do you think it's kind of manufactured, or do you talk to Joy about it?
No, it's not manufactured. It's not manufactured. It's not like Real Housewives. No, it's not manufactured. I know for a fact it's not manufactured. Do I follow it? I don't really watch that often, but I do speak to Joy almost every day.
Yeah.
So
So you get the inside scoop.
I know what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. Her blowups with Meghan McCain became a thing before she finally left the show.
They were fun to watch, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. They were
fun
to watch.
That's good TV.
Yeah, I'm sure they realized that was good TV, even if there was some reality behind
it. Yeah. Well, they just had differences of opinion. Let's put
it
that
so.
Way.
Yeah. The other old clip that I just watched was your Friars Club roast of Donald Trump from 2004, which is a special thing.
Well, you know, they say you only roast the ones you love. I add or are indifferent to. At that time, it was like a last minute thing. Somebody backed out and they asked me to fill in. And to me, he was just some, you know, like television guy. He wasn't. Who knew that he was going to end up being so lethal?
Yeah, you didn't know you were roasting a future president either.
Correct. And I would never roast him now because I would never give him that attention.
Yeah, yeah. I love that you immediately go after him as sort of a horrible, womanizing, you know, asshole.
Well, he was. He was easy to roast. You know, I think my opening line was about his hair. It was a luncheon. And I said, Donald, did you enjoy your lunch? I hear your hair ordered the salmon.
We met once, but you won't remember because you weren't trying to sleep with me. And, you know, that's because I'm not your type. It's okay because, you know, I'm smart, my tits are real, and I speak English. I'm not attracted. You're not my type. It's not that I'm not attracted to you. Well, I'm not, but you're not my type because it's like the ego thing. Because I don't like to go out with a guy who calls out his own name when he's coming. You know what I mean? And the handshaking bother, you know that Donald doesn't like to shake hands. And it's not because he's germophobic. It's just that he jerks off so much that he considers anything else cheating. And what's with the ooze? It's a fucking roast, okay?
I love that line.
But then you really go after him for the way he treats women, which I thought was interesting, that even then, you know, it was sort of a well-known...
It was
thing.
Of course it was.
Yeah.
How did this happen?
Yeah.
How did that man? Oh, I don't even like to talk about him or mention his name or give him any energy whatsoever.
Yeah. Do you think, was he able to, did you perceive that he was able to laugh at himself then? Because I mean, he really can't anymore.
Well, you know, and what's interesting is, yes, I was actually, I remember that day quite well. And I was surprised that he was gracious. And he was quite gracious. However, it was all about him. So that was that other you know, narcissistic aspect. I think he loved that it was all about him, positive or negative. But what's interesting is I personally think the reason he ran for president in the first place was because of a roast, what Obama did to him at the Washington Correspondents' Dinner. I think that it all started in that moment that he humiliated him. And that's when he went, that's when he started with all that other crap. I think so. It all started because of a comedy bit.
Isn't that crazy?
And look what happened. And we're not free yet.
The other show that your part that you've done that I really wanted to talk about because I love it so much is Broad City.
Broad City,
which is a favorite of mine. And you're so fantastic on that show. How did you end up playing Alana Glazer's mother?
After the first season, I got a call from my manager telling me there were these Alana Glazer and Abby Jacobson wanted to take me to dinner. I had no idea who they were. And I think I think the show hadn't aired yet, actually.
Oh, okay.
The first season hadn't aired yet. So I looked up their webisodes, which is, as you know, is how they started. They were two Upright Citizens Brigade people, and they couldn't get arrested. So they started, as I think is so fantastic, they started this web series they did it themselves. And then it got picked up and was put on County Central. So I watched the web series and I was like, oh, these girls are really funny. I thought it was funny. And then I went to dinner with them and they were taking me to dinner to talk to me about playing Alana's mother. They wanted me to play Alana's mother. And I just fell in love with them. I'm still very close with them. I just fell in love with them and just thought they were so smart and that was that. I mean, I just working with the first one I did was Knockoffs, which I still think is one of the best.
The Bags.
The Bags. And that was written by Paul Downs and it was directed by Lucia Agnello, who then went on to do Hacks,
so
brilliantly.
Fantastic, yeah.
Yeah. And they were it was just such a great group of people to work with. And I was thrilled to be on that show. Just thrilled.
Abby, sweetheart, let me know if you want me to get you a bag when I go to Chinatown later, okay? I love bags.
You guys enjoy the day together. I'm actually late for my non-date hangout, you know.
Don't forget to wear a condom, Abby.
Alana, I don't wear a condom.
Wow. That's just how she says goodbye to people.
Yeah, I care.
Okay. All right, well, have fun.
Ugh. Will you look at that gorgeous tush?
Oh my God, it's perfection.
Talking about my butt?
Yes.
Yeah, so that episode where you go to Chinatown to buy the bags and you're...
Oh, that's an example of like, I guess I got to learn Chinese now. I mean, they throw things at you and it's like... And what was really funny about that was Chinese is... It's not like learning if I had to do Spanish or something. I mean, Chinese is like a whole other... There was an interpreter there, and then there was, the location manager. And one was Cantonese, and one was Mandarin. And they kept on telling me different
things. Oh, God.
Because it's like a different language. And finally, I was just like, put an IFB in my ear. I cannot figure this.
Just repeat it.
Because so much is inflection. Like you say, it's not so... Whatever I ended up saying, I know was completely wrong, but I don't think it really mattered.
But for the joke to work, it has to really sound like you know what you're doing.
I think I faked it pretty well.
You faked it pretty well, yeah. I didn't know. You fooled me. That show is so, so good. So what I want to do now is our segment called The First Laugh, and I'm going to ask you about a bunch of firsts in your life and career.
Okay. Hit me.
All right. So I want to go all the way back to, do you remember the first piece of comedy or one of the first that really made you laugh hard as a kid?
Yeah, I was 5 years old. It was 1960 and it was Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner 2000 Year Old Man album.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was it about that?
I mean, I probably
laughed
at cartoons and stuff before that, but I don't remember.
What was it about that really connected with you?
Well, thinking about it, I mean, I could listen to it now and it's still so funny. It was funny, but at five, I couldn't possibly have understood half the material. I didn't know who Joan of Arc was. I couldn't have understood. But I think it was something in the rhythm of it. It was musical to me. It was something in the rhythm and the music of it that touched my funny bone. And also, you hear people laughing. You know, you hear the audience laughing. So laughter is so contagious. But I know it was the rhythm of it because I could... My father used to do things like I would stand on the kitchen table and I would do both Carl and Mel parts and I would do the whole album, you know, perform it for my family from beginning to end. And I had it down perfectly. My father would say a line from it, but he would have it wrong. Like he would take a word out or add a word or something. And the rhythm was off, and it was like nails on a blackboard to me. Like he was singing flat, you know? So there's something in the musicality of it. People talk about, can teach people to be funny. The timing and the rhythm, you either have that or you don't. I don't think that could be taught. You could learn how to write a joke, but that kind of rhythm, you either have it or you don't.
Yeah. That kind of connects to my next question, which is the first time that you knew you were funny.
You know, I remember very young, you know, maybe 3 or 4, my grandmother was really funny. And I spent a lot of time with my grandmother, and maybe 3, I don't remember exactly when, you know, those memories are vague, but I remember somehow being aware of being funny, of making people laugh, and what that did for me in the world. That when you made people laugh, they liked you, they responded to you in a positive way, you got what you needed from them in some sense. Because, you know, I had a very contentious relationship with my mother. My mother was a real depressive. That was another thing. So many comedians, female comedians, that had depressed mothers. I think we were all trying to make our mothers laugh all the time, was another aspect. But I saw the response that I got being funny, and it was a positive thing. So it became a survival mechanism for me.
What do you remember about the very first time you performed stand-up on a stage in front of people?
I remember that I did something that I have never done since, which is I had a glass of wine before I went on because I was such a nervous wreck. And I was lying, I was on my floor in my apartment, rocking back and forth. I was so, and I think I had like a 5-minute spot, and I did it in like 2 minutes. I did it so quickly, and my mouth was so dry. And that's all I remember.
Yeah. Did you get any laughs?
Yes, I did get laughs.
Well, that's pretty good then.
A lot of people get laughs the first time, and then they think they're all that. And then they go up the second time. It's like, different.
I hear that over and over
now.
Again. The first time, the second time does not go like as well as the first time.
Exactly.
Do you remember the first joke that you told or bit that you had that really worked on an audience that you could keep going back to that you felt really good about?
Well, when I first started, I didn't speak in my own voice. I used to just do these characters, and they were imitations of people, you know, my grandmother and my mother and just people that I knew. So those all worked. And I did that for several months until I learned how to actually speak. It was Joy that actually helped me with that, because when I first saw Joy on stage, this was in 1983. When I first saw her on stage, it was a realization that, oh, I see what she's doing. She's just being herself. She's the most herself person on stage that I've ever seen. She's just being herself, like the way I am around the kitchen table talking to my girlfriends is, and that's what I have to do. So that's when I had to develop that. It's not easy to be yourself. No.
Well, easier to hide behind a character, right?
Yeah.
So I know you made in 1988, you were in 2 films, Crocodile Dundee 2 and Punchline were sort of like your co-film debuts. Do you have a story from either or both of those that sticks out in your memory from filming those?
Crocodile Dundee 2, not much, because that was just one day of shooting. But Punchline, I was in it, but I was also hired to be Sally Field's coach.
Oh yeah.
I was her comedy coach. So I worked on that for a good 3 months. I was in LA. It was my first time in a studio. I was in Hollywood all of a sudden, you know, and I was at Sally Field's house. And, you know, I remember picking up her Oscar and feeling like All About Eve. But she would not. I would write material for her and work with these other comedy writers writing material for her. But, you know, comedy material, you have to try out on an audience. And she wouldn't go out and go into clubs I don't blame her. I mean,
yeah.
It's
Sally
a really,
Field,
Tom,
yeah.
Tom Hanks did at the time. He was playing a comic also. So Tom and I would go out to clubs and I would try the material out.
Yeah. And see how, and bring
see
it back
how
to her.
It worked, and then bring it back to her. It was a real learning experience. I saw how a movie was made. I was there every day. I was on set every day, so that was a real privilege in a way.
How did Tom Hanks do in the clubs?
Oh, he's funny. He did well. He knows how to deliver.
Yeah, she was probably more famous than he was at that time. Maybe that's why
he
felt more comfortable doing it.
Yeah, that was the very beginning of his career.
Yeah, yeah, that's so funny. And then I believe you made your late night TV debut on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson in 1989. But you were on panel. You didn't do stand up, which I thought was interesting. Did you want to do stand up on the show?
No, my stand up never lent itself to those kinds of 5-minute spots. I was more of a storyteller and characters and improvising. So, you know, those spots, you had to have a tight, you know, that was set up punch time, and that was never my forte. So no, I didn't ever want to do stand up on any of those shows. I was in a TV series at the time called Baby Boom. It was an NBC series. So they got me on because it was an NBC show, and it did not go well at all. The spot. No, I think Johnny did not know that I was a comic. He thought I was just like some young NBC ingenue coming on the show. And I was a little raunchy and a little dirty, and he wasn't expecting it. And we didn't have a rapport.
Yeah. So you didn't feel great about it after
No, I felt horrible about it. And that was the most nervous I've ever been in my life.
I can imagine. Yeah, that must have been, it's a really big deal for anyone to go on that show and for a comedian.
Well, especially growing up the way that I grew up, where that was it. It's different now. You know, I mean, that was it. It was the Tonight Show.
Yeah, there was nothing else. Yeah.
Merv Griffin, you know, there was nothing else.
One other thing I learned about you that I didn't know was you were a correspondent briefly on The Daily Show at the very beginning.
You know, apparently I was, and I have no memory of it.
It's on your resume.
I was. Like, if I think about it, yeah, I was, but I don't remember it.
This was pre-John Stewart, I think.
No, I think it was John.
It was with John?
I think so.
We'll never know.
I don't remember. I really don't remember.
That's
it's
so
been
funny.
A long career.
We're going back to Curb. What do you remember the very first scene that you shot on Curb?
And how
it went and what it was like?
It was really a nothing scene. I was there. What I do remember is I something else was going on, but it was really just more introducing Jeff's wife Susie. But there was no real scene for me. But we were talking about Sammy. And Jeff's parents were there, you know, Louis Nye and Mina Kolb, both brilliant. I don't know if Mina's still alive. Louis died. But Sammy was at that time a boy.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
I don't remember that. Yeah.
And then in the next season, he became a girl because then because of the doll.
Yeah.
Larry had written the doll. Yeah. I remember that very well.
There wasn't much to the scene though,
it wasn't much. I didn't have much. My main thing in that season was what I referred to before was the wire Fresh Air Fun Kid robs us. I remember that very well too. Larry Charles was directing that. I remember it very well.
Yeah, yeah. I know you often get recognized on the street by fans of Curb who want you to you know, scream obscenities at them.
Yes.
Do you have a particularly memorable interaction with a fan that stands out in your memory?
No, because they're all pretty much the same. But I do remember probably the most inappropriate time somebody asked me to do that was at my mother-in-law's wake.
Someone you knew or just
no one I knew.
And they just what did they say to you?
Oh, could you yell at me and curse at me? I was like, no.
Why did they think that was a good place to ask?
Exactly. Why?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Yeah. That could be a storyline in Curb.
It could be.
Yeah.
It probably was.
Maybe it will be. And then finally what I like to do is ask comedians to shout out other comedy or comedians that really make them laugh. So what's the last piece of comedy or comedian or something that's really making you laugh right now?
Well, I don't watch much comedy. You know, I really don't. The people that make me laugh are usually the things that really make me laugh are usually real life things, stuff that happens in life. But I mean, I have favorite. There's certain comedians that can just crack. Gilbert Gottfried, for example, will make me laugh no matter what. We'll just look at each other and I'll just break up. Larry really, and I mean, it sounds like so disingenuous for me to say, Larry really makes me laugh.
I believe it.
Yeah. I hate this question because I know I'm going to leave out people that I think are really funny and that are friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
God, who really makes me laugh? I mean, there's so many funny people out there that really make me laugh. You know, Alana and Abby really make me laugh. Joy makes me laugh every day, but that's just in real life, not stand up. I'm having dinner with my friend Mario Cantone next week. He really makes me laugh. So many people make me laugh.
Well, I've been trying to get Joy on this podcast for a while, and I've not been successful. So maybe you can put in a good word for me.
I will put in a good word, man.
But I'm so glad that we got to do this, and thank you so much for coming on. And I'm such a huge fan of you and of Curb, and this was really a lot of fun.
Thanks.
So thank you.
And by the way, how great last night's episode was. They're just getting better and better.
Yeah, I can't
wait. We have some episodes 7, 8, 9, and 10 are off the charts.
Fantastic. I'm looking forward to that.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Just a huge thank you to Susie Essman for joining me on this week's show. You can watch new episodes of Curb Your Enthusiasm every Sunday night at 10:30 p.m. on HBO and stream all 11 seasons on HBO Max. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next week on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.